Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
In the 1980s, cocaine was supreme, and Pablo Escobar was the king. He sold over $400 million worth every week during his prime. Could his kingdom, full of sex, drugs, and salsa, ever crumble? And how could he ever be stopped? This is True Crimecast.
This is True Crimecast. Jamie and John here on a very rainy day. I feel like rainy days are great for listening to crime stories.
Well, that's true. It's also great for recording them. I just hope the weather wherever you are is sunny and 70. Kind of like Columbia, South America.
Yeah.
No, it's really hot down there, and there's a lot of cocaine. We're going to be talking about that later. What are we doing now?
I guess we're preparing to talk about cocaine. John, we have so many people that have joined our Patreon lately, and I just want to give all them a big thanks. We released a new episode last Thursday that was really strong, in my opinion, and we have so many episodes over there. But a big thanks to Alyssa, a big longtime Patreon supporter, finally back on board. Alyssa, we're glad to have you back.
Good to have you back, Alyssa. I'm going to chime in there, too, on that one. We've known her for, gosh, years. So good to have you back.
It's been a long time. Big thank you to Nathaniel, who's going to get a signed autograph and a special shout-out. John, what do you got to say to Nathaniel in Australia?
Good day, mate. No, I feel like you deserve more than that. Nathaniel, we're so glad to have you over on Patreon. I hope that you enjoy the content. Listen, the last few months over there has been pretty dark. There's also some lighthearted stuff. I think it's a healthy mixture of both. So I hope you enjoy it, and we're so glad to have you.
We also have some Australian cases coming up on this feed, so stay tuned for that. Big thanks to Guy, Faye, Michael, who all came in at the $3 level to get those episodes each and every month. Dana joined and took advantage of the discount to pay for a full year. So she's going to go ahead and not have to pay us again for 12 months to get access to our Patreon content. And last but certainly not least, thanks to Britt for joining at the $3 level as well. We appreciate all of your support. We're at an all-time high for Patreon supporters. We've teased for years, if we get 200, we're going to come visit somebody. We're getting closer.
We're getting there, almost three quarters of the way, if my math serves me well. So, guys, thank you all so much. Dana, I'm going to give you a special shout-out. Girls from Jellicoe, where I'm from. So, Dana, good to have you on here. I've known you forever. Glad to have you on here.
Good. Awesome. Always good to have people from the hometowns that understand what we're talking about and understand our accents, which are key for today's case. We're talking about Pablo Escobar. So, there's obviously going to be a lot of stuff that we struggle with pronunciation wise, so bear with us.
As some of the reviews have pointed out lately, my English sucks, so Lord knows my Spanish isn't going to be much better. Give me patience. If you want to write a review about my language, just send me an email. I mean, you ain't telling me something I don't already know.
Just because he can't talk doesn't mean he can't read, right?
Well, here we go.
On December 1st of 1949, in the city of Rio Negro, Colombia, a middle-aged couple, which is key here, a middle-aged couple, welcomed the birth of their third child. Although that couple had a normal, healthy, middle-class lifestyle and family home, working as a farmer and a school teacher, their son would grow up to become one of the most notorious and feared names in the illegal drug world. And I think that's super interesting, John, that he didn't come from poverty. Pablo Escobar didn't get in the drug game to get out of a bad situation or because he was exposed to that, to being a low-income individual. He chose to be a criminal.
By the time he was in his early teen years, Pablo Escobar had already earned a reputation in the nearby city of Medellin. He was engaging in some petty crimes that foreshadowed his criminal and violent future in the organized crime and narcotic scenes. As a teen, he would break into local cemeteries under the cover of night to steal tombstones made of expensive materials like granite or marble. Gotta say, in the few years that we've been doing this, never heard of anybody stealing tombstones.
Yeah, we've seen grave robbers taking valuables from the bodies, but this is a new one for me.
he made a pretty decent amount of money by reselling this stone to local stonemasons who would grind up like the inscriptions and then resell them. So dude had like a very enterprising mind at an early age, right?
It's got to be a very niche market. You got to find stonemasons that are shady.
Although he was making a pretty decent income as a high school teenager doing this and other small-time criminal stuff, young Pablo Escobar quickly expanded his services to forgery. For a price, he would produce fake diplomas for paying customers, which is how your boy got his high school diploma.
Thank you, Pablo Escobar.
No, actually, that reminds me, there's a case from my hometown of Jellicoe where a guy forged a college degree in order to eventually become a principal at a school. We covered that case over on True Crime Cast years and years ago.
Yeah, well, there's also a case of a basketball coach that got hired to coach. His name was Steve Masiello. And when they did the check for him to coach the team, they found out that he didn't really graduate from the University of Kentucky.
Nice. Now, of course, these things were just the stepping stone for things that were to come. Escobar would eventually move on to some more serious crimes, including, and I love this one, selling fake lotto tickets. That's pretty impressive.
That is. I mean, you're never going to win. What if they did hit? I mean, they would obviously show up and see that they were forged and I'd give them the money, but yeah, that's really messing with somebody.
Yeah. He also did some auto theft and muggings. So he, you know, this at first it was just stuff that would help make him money. And the only thing that were hurting people were their loss of money, but now he's turning into some violent crimes too. By the time he was in his early 20s, Escobar had fallen in with some more seasoned criminal types in Colombia, and under their influence, he carried out some of the most daring schemes to date. Now, this would be one of the biggest things that come to my mind is kidnapping a wealthy businessman for ransom. The plot worked, and Escobar supposedly earned $100,000 for his role. After witnessing the huge sums of money that could be earned for just a little bit of work or skill in the impoverished Colombia, Escobar set an ambitious goal. He wanted to rise through the organized crime ranks so that he earned $1 million before his 22nd birthday. Before his death decades later, Escobar far surpassed that goal, and he was actually, according to Forbes, one of the wealthiest individuals in the world.
He was making well over $1 million a day at one point.
I remember in my research, I saw a number of like $450 million a week.
Yeah.
Like, dude could buy a Jeep Wrangler if he wanted to right now. He could buy anything he wanted.
Maybe he couldn't afford lumber right now, but that's a different story.
That's true.
In the 1970s, the international drug trade was booming. And I know we think of Colombia as being like the hub of that. Well, it wasn't until Pablo Escobar. The demand for cocaine was really high in wealthy nations, especially the United States. Colombia quickly became the epicenter for cocaine production, and mules would smuggle it into the U.S. and sell it for a huge profit. In 1975, Pablo Escobar broke into the cocaine scene. He rented small planes to fly from Colombia and land at private airports in the United States, where they were less likely to be searched by authorities. The scheme proved highly profitable, and before he was 26 years old, he had a net worth of more than $3 million. He reinvested that money to expand his drug operations, buying 15 larger planes and a fleet of helicopters to transport the cocaine. As his international drug smuggling empire grew, so did his profile with law enforcement. In 1976, he was arrested with his crew as they tried to smuggle cocaine into Colombia from Ecuador. Now, this is when Escobar would really start to exercise the power that came with what he was doing. He tried to bribe some judges and police in this case, but that didn't work out. And while he was awaiting trial, he ordered his men to kill two police officers, the ones that arrested him. And when that happened, the case was quickly dropped. The execution of his enemies would be the hallmark of Escobar's criminal career. So we're not just talking about a drug runner here. He became a ruthless murderer that killed for anybody that crossed him, no matter how small the betrayal was. Meanwhile, in the United States, there was nearly insatiable appetite for cocaine in the late 70s and early 80s. So his drug running operations continued to boom. He worked out routes via planes and cargo ships to smuggle drugs into the major ports of the United States, getting these drugs into the big cities. He even bought a private island off the coast of Florida to serve as a relay point in the smuggling routes. The island included a private airport, houses, hotels, a harbor, hangars for his planes, and a climate-controlled warehouse solely for cocaine. The drug-running scheme was making him so much money that he built one of the most elaborate estates in South America, which he named Hacienda Nápoles. The estate was nearly 8 square miles and included a mansion, statues of dinosaurs, 3 different zoos, a lake, a sculpture garden, and homes for the top lieutenants in his organization. The gate leading to this estate was crowned with the first plane he used to smuggle drugs. It was almost like you see people in those restaurants that put the first dollar they made up on the wall. This was his first drug plane that he chose to put on the post at the entrance. The zoos had hippos, zebras, camels, elephants, giraffes, and he also had an extensive collection of rare and classic cars, and those would eventually be destroyed by a rival cartel. He also collected animals like tigers and had them as pets and that kind of thing. This essentially, he owned his own city. He got to a point, John, where he was so rich that he really kind of ran out of ideas of how to spend his money. And at that point, power became the driver behind everything he was doing.
I can't imagine being able to see something that I want, no matter how expensive it is, and just drop the cash right there on the spot to pay for it.
Yeah.
Like he could buy anything.
He would purchase rare vehicles like you and I would purchase a pack of gum.
Yeah.
Sure. I'll throw that in, right?
Yeah.
At the peak of his career, which was around 1982, he used his wealth and notoriety to win a seat in the Colombian Congress. So this isn't like a dirty politician. This is a drug lord turned politician. His role in the government put a bigger target on his back for the American government specifically, but also other Colombian politicians who wanted to end his drug ring. By this point, most of the cocaine in the United States was brought in via Escobar's gang, and he controlled most of the production and coca crops as well. John, it said that he provided 80% of the cocaine that was sold.
In the world.
Yeah, that's a lot of coke.
But, like, it's unfathomable. He would, like, move 15 tons of cocaine every day into the United States alone. Like, my dad's in the coal business, and I would wake up early during the days of my summer as a kid, and I would hear him like arranging for coal cars, like, or for trucks, you know, like, hey, I need about 30 tons over here, 50 tons over here. Like, that's what he's doing, but in a cocaine.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's like it's a mineral that the world needs to survive.
Well, in the 80s in America, kind of was, especially like in Miami.
It was certainly a sign of power and wealth. If you had cocaine at your parties, then people knew that you were somebody. So it was a sign of that.
As unbelievable as his career had been in the mid-1980s, 1985 was really a turning point when Escobar literally invaded the Colombian federal government. Like, who does this and can get away with it other than Pablo Escobar?
I mean, we've certainly seen revolutions, right? Like, we broke up with England via a war, but he's hiring these mercenaries because he has unlimited resources to say, you know what? I'm tired of the government on my back. Let's just take it over.
I say who can do that, but I mean, there was an insurrection in America less than 6 months ago.
Yeah.
They didn't achieve nearly as much as Pablo Escobar did. So April 19th, he was one of the masterminds behind a scheme to send armed men into the building of the Colombian Supreme Court. Now, he learned that his name was one of the many being investigated by the Supreme Court, and he sent his guys in to destroy all of the documents relating to his criminal affairs inside that building. So when he was in there, hostages were taken inside the building and released only after he had assurances that he would not be extradited to the U.S. to face drug smuggling charges. An early attempt to avoid being extradited to the States was denied. Get this, when Escobar promised to pay off the entire national debt of Colombia, which was $10 billion.
With a B.
Billion. So could you imagine? Like, hey, I'm going to pay off your entire national debt. Only caveat is you can't let me go back to the United States.
I mean, essentially, he's a booster of the Colombian program at that point, right? Like, he's paying to get his way and have his influence heard, which unfortunately may be how the world works.
Yeah, and you know, he was doing that, you know, to kind of cover himself, but I think he also wanted to even have more power. Like, he was a congressman at one point, but I think he wanted to be, like, the king of Colombia.
Yeah.
You know? Now, $10 billion. It's, you can't even comprehend how much money that is, but that would have been like less than half of his net worth at the time.
Crazy.
By that time, Escobar was at the height of his power and at the height of his financial career, his money. The cartel that he was with had earned $70 million every day. So kind of thinking about it in 2021 dollars, that's $150 million per day. So approximately $55 billion per year in American dollars, like today's money. I mean, that's insane.
That's like a million bajillion dollars.
That's more than Oprah money,
man. $11 billion.
Like, Oprah doesn't have Escobar money.
Yeah.
It's crazy. You get some coke and you get some coke. Anyway. And like we said before, he owned over 80% of the world cocaine market. And I don't know. I just want that to sink into you. Like, 80% of the cocaine that was distributed or sold illegally around the world was Escobar's. Like, I think about Breaking Bad, and he kind of had the market on a few cities and eventually spread. Like, this guy owns the world's market.
Yeah, we have laws against monopolies here in the United States because that comes with so much power, and it certainly came with that much power for Escobar.
Although he was known for being a ruthless person in killing officials or anyone who got in his way, some Colombians saw him as a type of Robin Hood who was always giving back to the poor. He built facilities and sponsored leagues for poor children to be able to play in sports and built homes for homeless people. He also built, with his own money, huge advanced hospitals which saved many lives in Colombia for people who were struggling to maintain decent health facilities. Many Colombian locals would actively help him to avoid capture by police when he was actively engaged in an illegal activity because they so appreciated his generosity. Despite those charitable contributions, Escobar's cartel had a lot of blood on their hands. By the early 1990s, Colombia was the world's murder capital, due in large part to Escobar hiring hitmen to kill thousands of police officers and political enemies. Again, I think some of these numbers need to sink in. He didn't just kill a few police officers, thousands.
Thousands of people. And it was, sometimes it was direct revenge on certain people. Sometimes it was just to send a message. Sometimes it was because people refused a bribe. They say that everybody's got a price, and if they don't, he would have put a bullet in their head.
And I'm sure we'll get to it eventually, but I mean, like, some of the ways that he killed people are still like almost fascinating and just creative at the time. And we kind of see them still being utilized today by other folks, like car bombings. That was something that Escobar kind of started. He had some help from some other folks in another country to help get that started. He put a bomb on a commercial airliner to kill multiple people at one time. How this dude didn't get caught much, much sooner is really kind of beyond me.
Power, man.
In 1989, Escobar arranged for the execution of the leading candidate for the presidency after the candidate kind of said some bad things about Escobar and his cartel. This proved to be the final straw, and Escobar surrendered to the police and vowed to give up his criminal enterprises in exchange for a lighter prison sentence. He continued to run his criminal dealings from prison. However, he was confined to his own private prison with no other inmates. There, he had a jacuzzi, a football field, a waterfall, and a private bar. How does this guy pull this off?
Well, that was part of the agreement. I'll go away, but I get to go to my private prison. His people were in charge of hiring the prison guards. People came and went as they pleased. So essentially, he's retiring to a resort.
When the media covered his lavish prison conditions, the Colombian government made arrangements to move him to a regular prison, but Escobar escaped before they could move him in there, and he spent the rest of his life on the run as a fugitive.
When we get back from the break, we'll talk about what life was like on the run for Escobar and how he was finally brought to justice. Jamie here. John and I really want to tell you about our other podcast in case you haven't checked that one out yet.
Yeah, man. It's called Bless Their Hearts. You can find it wherever you find your favorite podcast. You can listen to us talk about anything from our favorite movies, desserts, or even aliens.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's really a palate cleanser of sorts for us to get our minds away from the crime world, and we'll talk about what it means to be redneck to us. We'll call our family members occasionally and bring in as many guests as we can to have a good time.
You guys don't want to miss it. Again, it's found wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Check out Bless Their Hearts today. The Colombian government, now responsible for trying to find the most wanted fugitive in the world, called on America's special forces to come in and help. Now, the United States government had long sought to extradite Escobar to the States and convict him for filling American streets with cocaine. So they happily agreed to join the search in hopes of extraditing him back to America to prosecute him. The Americans helped train a special branch of the Colombian police whose sole mission was to find and capture Pablo Escobar. In addition, the families of thousands of people he had killed pulled their money together to assist in the search. It was around this time that it was rumored that his daughter was culled one night while they were on the run, and Escobar burned $2 million to keep her warm. I have a hard time believing that, just because I'm sure there were other materials to burn.
Yeah, I think some of this stuff is like glamorized and somewhat Hollywoodized, if that's a word.
It becomes almost a legend. Like, it said that he spent tens of thousands of dollars a year on rubber bands for his cash. But that's probably not accurate, but it's just part of the legend that grew out of this.
Yeah, it's like an elaborate game of telephone.
During the search for Escobar, police and his victims killed over 300 of Escobar's former accomplices, and most of his property was seized and destroyed. So essentially, this is a war. This is Escobar's army against the Colombian government with U.S. forces as backup. About a year and a half after his escape, police tracked Escobar in December of 1993 via a cell phone signal to a middle-class suburb in his hometown. Now, he had been calling his family. His family had tried to escape to America, but that was blocked by the government. The U.S. government canceled their visa, so they couldn't go there. They eventually went to Germany, but they were extradited back to Colombia at that point, and they were essentially put up in a hotel. He was able to call them, but of course they were monitoring this, and they were able to track his cell phone because he stayed on the phone for too long. Eight officers would surround the home he was staying in and made entry. Escobar attempted to escape by climbing to the roof while he and his bodyguard exchanged gunfire with police. At this time, he was no longer traveling with an entourage. He had one guy with him who was supposed to protect him. As Escobar jumped from roof to roof in the neighborhood, he was shot three times and ultimately killed by a Colombian federal law enforcement officer. Bullets pierced his leg, his torso, and his head, killing him the day after his 44th birthday.
You mentioned that he didn't have like an entourage anymore. He had the one guy. Yeah, that one guy was actually shot and killed as this whole event was playing out. And there are some folks that believe that the bullets exchanged from the officers weren't the ones that killed Escobar. It's kind of rumored that he might have shot and killed himself to avoid being captured. He said he would say over and over throughout his last few years that he would rather die and be buried in Colombia than to go sit in the jail in America. So I don't know. We can process that at the end if you want.
No, absolutely. He had always said that to people, that he would commit suicide if he was ever about to be captured. So some people believe that happened, but I think the Colombian government kind of wanted to take credit for taking him down. So no matter what happened, the narrative became that they took him down. I also want to talk about being his 44th birthday. I mean, I'm not 44. I can see it from where I'm sitting. And to think, like, I hate to use this word, but think about all he accomplished in his life by the time he was in his early 40s.
I mean, honestly, he probably could have retired before he was 25.
Yeah.
You know, But I don't think when you're in that position and you can see the potential to earn more and more and more, you're not going to quit. You know, that's it's a too good of a taste in your mouth to quit.
Yeah, the greed and I think ultimately the power is what continued to drive him and ultimately led to his demise. People across South America, especially Colombia, mourned his death. Like you said earlier, even though he killed thousands of people in brutal fashion, his charitable giving to the poor left him in high regard with a lot of people, and that source of funds was no longer available. Close to 30,000 people attended his funeral, and many still consider him a saint that served his country, and some even pray to him. Although he's been dead for decades, Escobar is still a feared figure. In 2006, a former girlfriend cooperated in an investigation into Escobar, arranging the assassination of a Colombian presidential candidate. She was later flown out of the country and placed in a secure housing environment by the United States government because of death threats from his former cartel, although he had long since been dead. He left behind a wife and two young children who were forced to flee the country after his death. They were allowed to move about at that point. They ended up settling in Argentina. His survivors have been extorted by rival gangs and forced to pay millions of dollars for Escobar's wars on rival gangs and drug smugglers. A lot of times, John, when we talk about criminals and them ending up getting caught and going away, we talk about how their families are also victims. They're victims of the circumstances that their criminal parent, the criminal leader of their family has led them into, and we think of them as victims, and a lot of times that's the case. But Escobar's wife ended up going to jail for nearly 2 years under suspicion of aiding illegal enterprises. And she would be later released, but she was caught involved in money laundering and fraud. And his children have been investigated for the same thing from time to time.
His wife and children would go on to enjoy the huge amounts of money that was left to them. But Escobar's sister has gone on a basically like an apology tour for her brother's actions, condemning his drug trade and apologizing to some victims. She regularly leaves notes for victims' families on the graves of people that her brother had killed. So, you know, I don't know why she feels like she needs to make amends for her brother, but it's kind of interesting that what he did would affect her in such a way.
And his son's come out, written a book that pretty much denounces all of his father's behaviors. They're really trying to break away from that legacy. But it's so hard to do that. There are certain names that just resonate with the public and will for decades after this. And Escobar is one of those. And I don't know how you get out from under that.
Now, the exact death toll from Escobar and his cartel is essentially unknown, but it's estimated that he ordered the deaths of almost 4,000 people, including the detonation of a bomb in 1989 that would take down a plane, like I mentioned earlier, which killed over 100 people in one time, including a newborn baby. So the Colombian government tried their best to dismantle Escobar's lavish lifestyle, and his estate would ultimately be demolished and refurbished into an amusement park. You remember we talked about his private zoo. Now that's still a part of that park. Interestingly, he had four pet hippos that were abandoned after his death, and they have reproduced so that that estate now basically has over 40 hippos kind of roaming free throughout it. And some of those hippos have turned violent and attacked humans. So it's kind of interesting to me that even after his death, he still has hippos that are out there hurting people. Like, you can't get away from Escobar.
Yeah, right. And those aren't really native to that area, but now they are populating and growing in population. So there's something to be said for ecological transport of species. I don't know how legal or illegal that is, but it sounds like it's not going well for Colombians.
Yeah. So as you can imagine, his life and just his lifestyle would lead to numerous books, TV shows, movies. One of the biggest ones I can think of that's currently on Netflix is Narcos. Have you watched that one, Jamie?
I haven't, but it's certainly a big popular show, and it really digs into a lot of this. Again, a lot of it's Hollywoodized, but I find that a lot of pieces of the story are so hard to believe that the reality is more hard to believe than fictional representations.
The DEA agents that took down Escobar from America are still alive, and their work is well documented. And it's fascinating to me. Like, part of me wants to be the DEA agents that take down the bad guys. The other part of me wants to make $450 million a week, you know?
Yeah, and man, so the criminal enterprise with the drugs, he certainly wasn't alone in that. That's still happening. There are people getting filthy rich off of the illegal drug trade, right? But what set him apart was really the violence. And it's really the first time that we see somebody, an individual from one of these big drug trades, become larger than life and larger than the industry. And he was so ruthless in that he would shoot people in the face for the most minor incident, and he would order hits on people, and he issued bribes because he could, because he had essentially unlimited money. And he, like you said, he could have just retired or like stayed, stand pat where you are at making $450 million a week and fade into the background. But the power got the most of him and kind of struck him down in his prime.
Yeah. They've even coined a term because of him. It's called narco-terrorist. So he was so violent, and it wasn't just regular terrorism. It was related to narcotics. So I thought that was interesting. Narco-terrorist.
And he invented, like you said, the car bombs, a lot of the ways that cartels transport drugs, but also that they carry out their violence came from Pablo Escobar. He kind of didn't invent the industry, but he took it to where it is now. He revolutionized it and made it a contemporary way to win the drug trade.
Yeah. It made me think of Breaking Bad, but this was real life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I thought it was interesting. One of Pablo's right-hand men was named Gustavo. And yeah. I don't think that's a coincidence that that's a major character on Breaking Bad. I just can't get over the sum of money. It's just mind-boggling to me how someone could have that much. What were you about to say?
Well, it's funny you mentioned Breaking Bad. I mean, Walter White was a school teacher who needed money to pay for treatments, and he ended up falling in love with the power and money that came with the drug trade. Pablo Escobar was in a middle-class family. He could have chosen to be a doctor, go to law school. He could have become a teacher, become an important part of his community, and use this skill set of, I don't want to say manipulation, but building relationships with people and thinking strategically to really improve his standing and improve his country and life for everybody around him. But he made the choice. I can get more satisfaction, money, and power going this illegal direction instead of all these other options I have in front of me. And I think that also separates him from a lot of the criminals that we discuss on this show.
Yeah. So I'm over here kind of thinking, is it worth it to just start a drug empire? And could I get my buddy Jamie to go in halvesies with me?
Do you know a chemist? I used to ask people that all the time when Breaking Bad came out. It's like, oh, you know chemistry, huh? Let's get together. But think about it from the eyes of those people that loved him and thought of him as like a Robin Hood. Like, I feel like that's also an element of the story that doesn't get played up, is it wasn't like everybody hated him. He built hospitals. He gave money to the poor. He fed people. Did he do that to win favor and to have support, or did he do that out of the kindness of his heart? It said that he was a really good father and would read to his kids till they fell asleep and was just this different person once he walked out the door.
You would think that most drug dealers would kind of live their lives in the shadows and not try to put the public eye on them, but he was kind of doing his thing, and he wanted everybody to know it. Like you said, I mean, I don't know if that was to make him look better than what he really was, or if he just had a good side in him somewhere. But I thought it was interesting. He didn't want to be hidden. He wanted to very much be known.
I find it hard to believe that he did have that good side. Obviously, if he valued human life in a way that he wanted to support it, then he wouldn't have taken so many lives, I would think.
Yeah.
Unless he justified it that he was killing bad people. I don't know. He probably saved a lot of bad people too.
Yeah, that's very logical. I don't know. This guy's hard to nail down. I'd like to really kind of speak to like a clinical psychologist and try to understand more of the mind of Pablo Escobar.
Yeah. Well, obviously his story is fascinating. I appreciate you listening in on this. Of course, there's no justice here. One man was responsible for the lives of thousands, and there's no bringing that back. I love telling stories like this. Something like this is almost fictional, so it feels less personal, but there are so many personal stories of people who were affected by this directly that you have to have your heart go out to those individuals. And it's not that far removed from our past. It's still very contemporary to us.
Yeah. I still kind of vaguely remember like news clips about this growing up. And it's interesting that here we are today talking about it. So guys, thank you all so much for tuning in, for sticking around with us. We had so many people join Patreon this week. It was outstanding. We love you guys so much. If you ever thought about it, what better time than right now to go ahead and get on patreon.com. When you're there, search for True Crime Cast. Go ahead and join our Patreon family and instantly get access to those just dozens of episodes that you have never heard before. You can get that today.
As always, the best thing you can do for us is ratings and reviews. Obviously, the more stars, the better, but we want you to vote your conscience on those stars. But we appreciate all the reviews. That gets us more visibility.
Guys, we appreciate you all. And until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.